It's Sports Day Plus with Trey Ellen.
Coming up on episode number 91 of Sports Day Plus. At 6:45, where are we at in society? Adidas is canceling the number 44, and a truly horrific story involving a 12-inch eel that ended up in a guy's stomach. And you can guess how it got up there. At 6:30, it is the first of a two-segment chat with comedian Ian Fidance, ahead of his shows at Creek in the Cave this weekend. And a mere seconds, the ACC scores a W against Florida State in their ongoing spat. And just what college basketball needs, competing consolation postseason tournaments. That may be coming down the pike next season. I am your host, Trey Elling. You can give me a follow on Twitter at Courtesy Wave. And do the same for ESPN Austin at 1027 ESPN. Well, the ongoing saga between Florida State, let's be honest, some other schools in the Atlantic Coast Conference, and the conference itself has taken a few steps forward or sideways or maybe even backwards, depending on how you look at these things. A judge in the Charlotte area in Mecklenburg County, which is where Charlotte, North Carolina is, on Thursday denied two motions filed by Florida State officials to dismiss or stay a lawsuit filed by the ACC that the league hopes will force Florida State and any other school that wants to leave the conference to honor its grant of rights agreement and have to pay the conference more than $500 million if the school hopes to exit for another conference before 2036. The ruling is reported on by ESPN.com, which came from Judge Louis Bledsoe III, is looked at as a huge win for the ACC, as it would likely mean that the battle between the league and Florida State will proceed in North Carolina rather than Florida, which is where Florida State filed its own lawsuit against the conference. Now, the ACC did put its lawsuit forth in Charlotte on December 21st, anticipating that Florida State would do the same, but in its home state of Florida, which actually did happen following approval by the school's board of trustees that following day. Florida State's lawsuit seeks to extricate the university from the ACC's grant of rights, a contract that gives the conference ownership of Florida State's television media rights through June of 2036. And that is the case for every other school in the ACC as well. Now, why is this significant? Because Florida law typically offers preference to the entity that filed the first lawsuit, which in this case was the ACC. Shame on Florida State officials for not acting a little bit sooner, for letting the cat out of the bag here and allowing the ACC to act first. The ACC, following the ruling today, said in a statement, quote, "We're pleased with today's decision, which confirms North Carolina courts are the proper place to enforce the ACC's agreements and bylaws. We remain committed to acting in the best interest of the league's members and will see this process through to protect and advance the ACC." Yes, you are committed to acting in the best interest of the league's members. That's why you added Stanford and Cal and SMU, right? It's in the best interest of the league's members or in the best interest of the conference offices and understanding that you are dangerously close to what happened to the Big 12 to a degree, although Brett Yormark has done a fantastic job of keeping the Big 12 relevant in football, but especially in basketball, but more specifically, what went down with the Pac-12. After the Pac-12 overplayed its hand in an attempt to regain a modicum of power, after Texas and Oklahoma announced that they would be moving to the SEC. The ACC is very close to this point right now, and if Florida State can figure out a way out of this grant of rights deal, and it's a fishy deal to say the least, one that is so fishy, you might argue, that the ACC is afraid to show anybody a copy of the deal itself. But if Florida State leaves, Clemson will likely try to leave. North Carolina will probably try to leave. Miami will try to find a new home someplace in the SEC or maybe the Big Ten. Probably not the Big Ten. SEC is their best hope. I don't know if Miami's a take at this point, if I'm being completely honest. Much to the dismay of Uncle Luke and any other fans of the U. But the ACC gets to celebrate a W today. Now, Florida State can appeal the ruling, potentially setting up arguments before the North Carolina Supreme Court. And keep this in mind, too, that on March 19th, Clemson did join Florida State in filing its own suit in Pickens County, South Carolina, arguing that the grant of rights should not apply if the school chooses to leave the ACC and that the league's requirement that any departing teams pay an exit fee of 3 times the annual revenue is excessive. ACC's argument will be, well, that's the deal that you signed, or that's the deal that we signed on your behalf. And then the ACC, because this is a circular story of lawsuits, did file a countersuit against Clemson, also in Charlotte a day later. So what does this mean in the grand scheme of things? The ACC is one up now on Florida State and Clemson and any other school that wants to leave its conference. But this is far from over with, and it will end with Florida State, Clemson, probably North Carolina, and any other school that wants out of the ACC leaving. And the ACC, if it's lucky, will be in that second tier of conferences, where it already is right now, by the way, even with some of these valuable programs at its disposal, that it's going to be on that level with the Big 12. There's nothing that you're going to do that is going to put you on par with the Big Ten and the SEC. It's just not going to happen. You're honestly lucky that your financial numbers are where the Big 12's is right now, or perhaps that's another testament to what Brett Yormark did in keeping the Big 12 relevant. But it's only a matter of time, ACC. Better figure out a way to make this right, otherwise it's going to get much uglier for you. I assure you it is. And it'll get ugly for these schools also, but it will end with them finding new homes. Since we're on the subject of college sports, we may as well, I don't want to say make mockery of college basketball. Some people have been excited about college basketball this year. Some cool storylines heading into this weekend's Final Four. How can you not root for that NC State team? Got a group of guys that are just easy to cheer for. It does seem like Purdue and UConn are destined to meet in a championship game on Monday night, but we'll just have to stay tuned to find out. We think we know how a sport, how a game is going to turn out, but that's why they play the games. And that's why we love sports too, to be honest, because you never know for sure. Can you tell me what's happening in the NIT right now? I cannot tell you. Sure, there are some fan bases who are mildly excited because their teams continue to advance in the NIT, or maybe the NIT is over with and the NIT has crowned a champion. No, not national champions, like what Shaka Smart's Texas program tried to claim a few years ago when they won an NIT, calling themselves national champs. Way to go full Aggie, guys. That was really embarrassing for the rest of us. But it looks like there will be another postseason consolation tournament in college basketball starting next year. And it's being spearheaded by Fox Sports and AEG. The College Basketball Crown will be a 16-team tournament that'll take place March 31st through April 6th in Vegas. The games will happen at the MGM Grand Garden Arena and T-Mobile Arena. Both venues have hosted college basketball games in the past. Teams who will be playing in this tournament are those that did not qualify for the NCAA tournament. The Big Ten, Big 12, and Big East, whose games are carried on Fox, will each have 2 automatic entries. Additional teams will be selected by a committee. I know competition is supposed to breed greatness, but competition breeds mediocrity here. You're not one of the 68 best teams in the country. And it sounds like if you're in the Big Ten, Big 12, and Big East, you won't have an option of not playing. You are playing. Even if your roster is already being decimated by the transfer portal, you're going to be playing in Vegas. So have fun with that. And a mediocre sport finds a way to somehow get even more mediocre. All right, coming up on the other side, it is a 2-segment conversation with the hilarious Eden Fidance ahead of his shows at Creek in the Cave this weekend.
It's Sports Day Plus with Trey Elling. It's Sports Day Plus with Trey Elling.
Ian Fidance is a longtime stand-up comedian who, amongst other things, has opened for Dave Attell for the past several years. He's not opening for anybody this weekend. He's actually headlining at Creek in the Cave. He is hilarious and well worth your time. Go to creekandcave.com to snag tickets. Two shows Friday, two shows on Saturday. Ian, thank you so much for the time. How you doing today?
I'm doing great, Trey. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, man, it's my pleasure. So I've seen you a couple of times now, as I mentioned in our Instagram DM correspondence. The first time, I think, was about a year ago, and it was a memorable show for a couple of reasons. One, you were featuring for Dave Attell, and then you actually come out on stage at the end of that show, and it's an incredible two-man-plus show or two-person-plus show. Because you bring the other comics up and you may get the crowd involved a little bit. So it was great because it was just a great comedy show. It was also memorable because it's the first time in my life I've been messed with by a comic. I was sitting front row, which of course is just asking for it from Attell. And sure enough, he called me a battle bot because I'm a 46-year-old guy with a faux hawk. It was great. And he said it really quickly and moved on too, to where it didn't resonate with the crowd, but I loved it personally. The third reason is because I was sitting right next to these two younger girls, and I'm not even kidding you, they were on their phones the entire time through the two openers and then up to you, which was a big mistake to do that with you on stage because you absolutely let them have it. I think you grabbed the phone at one point. You started hammering one of the girls for some dude that clearly didn't like her, that she's sweating. Do you remember this at all? Because it was an awesome moment for me.
Oh, yeah. That was at Cap City, right?
Yep, exactly.
Yeah. I remember that. Yeah. I don't know. I came up in Philly, man. I'm from Delaware.
Yeah.
And I started comedy in Philly, and then I moved to New York. I guess it's like an East Coast thing. Like, I don't take from anyone. And I'm wildly mentally ill in the sense that if a room full of people are loving it and there's one person who's not into it or they're doing something, I hyper focus on that. And while I'm talking, a voice gets louder on my head that's like, address. So I just had to do it. And I remember that. That was really, really fun. Yeah.
Well, that's asking for it.
I think I called a boyfriend on stage, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's asking for it too, though. If you're distracted by your phone, and look, there's a lot of places that are smartly now, and the Mothership is obviously one of these places, as you guys saw a couple weekends ago, where they just have you put your bag in a pouch so it's not even a distraction. The fact that they thought that they were okay doing this, sitting at the stage, was bizarre to say the least. And I'm hoping that it's the last time that if they're ever at a comedy show that they're pulling something like that.
Oh yeah. It's insane. The things that people think are okay to show and to be in the front row of a comedy show and just be on your foot. She wasn't even like typing like this. I distinctly remember she was like lifting it up because she was drunk too. So she's like, well, if I lift it up, that'll make it easier to read. And it's crazy. It's insane. And sometimes you got to let these motherfuckers know, you know what I mean? So I guarantee they're never doing that at a comedy show again. So there you go.
Yeah, exactly. So you've been to Austin on several occasions now, performed all over the place. You're going to be at Creek in the Cave this weekend, which for me personally, I would be excited to see it, except I'm going to be out of town. I'm going to be in West Texas of all places. But does it surprise you at all, having been in Austin like you have, to see this place turn into such a stand-up mecca like it has over the last few years?
You know, I mean, I think Austin was ripe for it because Austin's such a great town. It's such a creative town. And, Austin was always a good comedy scene. And I think they just needed, something to put them over that little hump, you know? And I think the Mothership has been a great thing for attracting not only comedians, but comedy fans. And, you know, I know, like, if you're a young comic, the idea is, you know, I just got to get down to Austin. But then the question is, well, what do you do when you're down there? You know, like, I know for me, it was you got to get to New York. And then I spent years being like, all right, I'm here. Okay. With no, like, drive direction, you know. But also, back when I started, we had the internet, but it wasn't like you film yourself, you put yourself on social media, and then you take off, you know, there was none of that. So it was just a lot of, I think for a while, I can only speak to my experience, but I think for a while it was just, okay, we're just going to grind out. And then the magic claw machine of Hollywood and the networks will pick you up and then place you in on the Tonight Show, and then you'll get placed on another thing. And it's definitely changed to where everything is on our power. It's in our hands. So, you know, I think people recognize that and they go, what's the best place to get up and get reps in and do as much as you can? I think that's awesome right now, you know, but I enjoy going down there. You know, I'll never leave. I'll never leave. I'm New York through and through, you know. Yeah. I still think the Mecca is New York. I mean, I think this is where you get great, you know. And
Well, it's because it's not just the comedy is so competitive. It's just the fact that the city is what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I noticed even though there's like tons of comedy, it's still like laid back down in Austin, you know. And up here, it's just, I don't know. There's just something that can't be replicated from New York anywhere else. And I take pride in that, you know.
So things got pretty messed up in a lot of big cities during COVID. Chicago, San Francisco, Portland, out in L.A., New York wasn't immune from that. Do you feel New York, because it is always a city that bounces back, it is starting to enter that bounce back phase, or things still pretty messed up there right now?
I mean, the only thing that hasn't bounced back is late night eating.
Oh, yeah.
Everything else is back. But, man, I'll tell you, it is so hard to eat late night. Places close. This used to be the diner, you know, destination. It was just everywhere. I can only count a handful of diners right now that are open 24 hours. And they're all spread throughout the city, you know. And so that's the one thing New York has lost is late night food. But aside from that, it's back, man. I know we were like ground zero for everything, and I stayed through it all. I didn't leave. And it was definitely wild to witness everything with my own eyes, but it's back. And all the credit, I have to say, needs to go to the arts and entertainment communities for keeping that going during the pandemic. I mean, I know as comics, we were out in fields, we were in parks, we were on sidewalks, we were on rooftops, we were in the back of people's houses doing these shows as early as June of 2020. And that helped bring a feeling of normalcy to things. And, you know, once they opened up Broadway and, you know, just like seeing people play music on the streets, like anything to make people feel normal was really cool. And so I know music and art and, you know, comedy was a big part of that.
Yeah, Sam Morril, he filmed a pretty good stand-up special on a rooftop. And the audience was a little bit weird, but it was still great material, though.
I opened all those shows for him. So I would get a call in the middle of the day because some of them were, you know, 25-year-olds apartments that were trying to, like, he would say, hey, why don't you throw a party on your roof and I'll do comedy? So I'm like, all right. So they're dealing with like, okay, we got all these people for this roof, and I get a call that's like, all right, the roof location is at 121 Water Street. I'm like, all right, I'll be there. You know, it was cool. There was something very DIY, do it yourself, guerrilla marketing about it too. That was really, really neat. It brought me back to like punk rock. It was really cool.
Yeah. And I think this renewed interest in stand-up is also a result of just how oppressed, for whatever reason, how oppressed everybody was through that first 6 months to a year to 2 years, depending on where you lived, on top of things getting weird language-wise, where you had people getting canceled theoretically based on things that were being said 5 to 10 years ago. Sometimes that stuff was taken out of context. Sometimes it was perfectly in context, but it's like, how long are we going to hold something over somebody's head and not allow any level of forgiveness in return? And people want to hear serious issues talked about in a joking manner. Now, you can do so in a way that's ignorant and hateful, and it shouldn't fly on stage. But those who do it the best, they often tend to poke holes on both sides, but they take these taboo issues and they are responsible enough to discuss those things to where people are laughing at the end of whatever the point is.
I totally agree, especially with the, poking holes on both sides. Anyone that claims they are one side and not anything of the other, I'm suspect about, you know, especially in terms of their point of view or their understanding of the world. I can't get down with extremism on either side. I think the goal is to always find truth, and the truth lies in the middle. And I'm not even saying that politically or anything. I'm saying that with everything. There's always two sides to everything, and both sides deserve to be made fun of,
exactly.
You know? And I think in terms of, you know, language and getting people in trouble, I travel the country every weekend. People are tired. They just want to laugh. The world is life is horrible. And how blessed am I that I get to go to different towns and help people forget about how terrible things are for an hour at a time by just laughing. I just love laughing. I think it's one of the best emotions that you can have and elicit from someone is laughter and joy. And I'm so fortunate that I get to bring that to different people in different towns. And I don't take it for granted, you know, and I hate comedians that waste people's time by trying to get serious with things or trying to teach them things. You know, at the end of the day, we're clowns. Okay. Don't forget that. We're traveling clowns. Okay.
Yeah. I almost hate to call it a cliche, but the whole cliche laughter is the best medicine isn't a cliche because it's true. It does help people to feel just better all about their overall disposition, being able to go out on a Thursday, yeah. Friday, Saturday night and just laugh senselessly, I guess, for an hour or so.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's true. Laughter is the best medicine, but I found out that that actually wasn't true during the pandemic when I went into hospitals and they kicked me out. So,
oh, God. He is Ian Fidance, a very funny stand-up comedian, as is evidenced by the fact that Dave Attell takes him on the road with him. That's right. He features for Dave Attell. He's not featuring for anybody this weekend, though, in Austin. He is in Austin headlining at Creek and the Cave. Two shows Friday, two shows Saturday. Go to creekandcave.com to snag tickets. Coming up, one more segment with Ian on the other side here on Sports Day Plus on 1027 ESPN and 1027ESPN.com.
It's Sports Day Plus with Trey Elling. It's Sports Day Plus with Trey Elling.
One more segment with the very funny Ian Fidance, a longtime stand-up comedian who currently is Dave Attell's feature. That's right, he leads into Dave Attell, one of the funniest comedians on the planet. He's not featuring for anybody this weekend. He's headlining at Creek in the Cave. Two shows Friday, two shows on Saturday. Go to creekandcave.com to snag tickets. And Ian, you mentioned last segment that you're from Wilmington, Delaware. Here's how little I know about Delaware. When I was doing a little bit of research for this conversation, I'm like, oh, I know one thing about Delaware. Washington crossed the Delaware to get to the Battle of Trenton, but the Delaware River was not in Delaware. It was in Pennsylvania into New Jersey. And The only other thing that I learned about Delaware in my limited research was that apparently it was very split during the Civil War. So for people like myself who are unfamiliar with Wilmington and or Delaware, what are those city and state all about?
Well, I got to thank you, Trey. You just did more research on Delaware than most Delawareans. So you're really doing great, man. Thank you. I grew up behind a shopping center off a main road that's like 5 minutes away from like the city, like bad city, you know? People don't realize that it's off 95.
Yeah.
So during the 2000s and everything with the opiate crisis, Delaware's the main pipeline from which all these drugs were funneling through down from Florida up to Delaware, Baltimore, Philly, New York, Boston. So people always forget, like, Delaware can hang when it comes to, you know, being tough and dealing with all this. Delaware is a part of it, but it's a drive-through state. People drive through, they don't stay. I love it. I love Delaware. It's the best place to grow up. It was a really cool little area because it's unique, you know, not many people are from there. And I'm glad I left. I'm glad I got out, but I always love going back, seeing people, seeing friends. It was split during the Civil War, actually. There's only three counties in Delaware. There's Newcastle County, Kent County, and Sussex County. And it's Delaware small, and it's bop, bop, bop. Hmm. And the lowest part of Delaware, which us Northerners put our heads up at, our nose up at, we call it slower, lower, because everything is so slow down there. That's the area that's like, am I in a time machine? Yeah. You know, that's the part of Delaware that's near the Mason-Dixon line. That's lower Delaware. But the majority of Delaware is great, man. And even to that part of Delaware is great, too, because you have to go down there for the beaches. So it's a cool state. It's really unique. Not many people give it credit, but It's got a lot of history. The last public shaming place in the United States took place in Delaware. The last stockade was in Delaware.
Oh, man, I feel like you would be an exceptional public shamer if such a job existed in modern times.
Well, you get on your cell phone at one of my shows, and it's happening, baby. Let's go.
Exactly. So you move from Delaware to Philadelphia, which is where you get your start in comedy. And I say what I'm about to say lovingly. I love this style. Philadelphia cranks out a bunch of really f***ed up comedians, and you're in that category. Then again, I'm somebody that as a kid, in elementary school, I wrote a story called Garfield, the Mass Murdering Cat, where Garfield gets fed up with all the a**s in his life and just goes on a murderous rampage. My teacher was extremely disturbed. I got called into the principal's office, but I did also get an A on that paper too, for whatever it's worth. What is it about Philadelphia that creates such a messed up and hilarious brand of comedy?
We're underdogs. No, we're New York's little brother. We're the town that nobody believes in. We're perennial losers. The Phillies are the most losingest franchise in the history of baseball. You know, you got to prove yourself. And I love that kind of place. I love those kind of people that it's like, nah, I'm not getting anything. I'm proving it. I'm working hard. It's a hard working town. And the only way to get better is through hard work, and no town, no place embodies it more than Philadelphia, you know, and Delaware too, for an extent, because I never lived in Philly. I used to drive from Delaware to Philly.
Oh,
to
is start that right? Comedy.
Yeah. So I would drive like 45 minutes up to Philly every night for open mics and everything, and then drive back down to Delaware.
Was that whole process starting about 13 years ago? Is that when you really started to get into stand up?
Yeah. February 1st, 2011 was my first open mic. And my buddy that I picked up, he and I are still thick as thieves today. He's doing great. His name's Tim Butterly. He's a really funny comic. Mm. And it's really cool, man. All the guys I started with were still in arms. We're still brothers in arms, you know, and like we're still, I was just with one of them last night. Kevin Ryan from the Are You Garbage podcast. We all started in Philly at the same place called the Raven Lounge. Mm. And 13 years later, you know, we've gone this way, that way, and we all come together. And that really means a lot to me, man. Everyone in my life that I keep in my inner circle is from Delaware, Philly, like old, like my manager I've known since I was 16, you know. I was in a punk rock ska band, and his sister used to drag him to the shows, you know. Mm. So I just love anyone that's been in my life for a while, especially from Philadelphia. And we're really lucky to have that. I know not a lot of people or comics have that.
Were you coming up at the same time? This may have been a little bit after Big J, but like the Big J's and Gillis and like David James, guys like that, were they still in Philly at that time too?
No, I was kind of in the middle of Big J and Shane. So Big J and Kev and Kurt Metzger and Joe DeRosa, they were like years and years and years ahead of us.
Oh, I didn't realize DeRosa was a Philly guy too. That makes sense though.
Yeah. Yeah. So they would all get in a car and Keith Robinson would drive them up to New York and they would hang, and he kind of put them over up in New York. And then, me and my Philly guys, we kind of all slowly started to move up and everything. And I went to school in New York. So I moved to New York in 2003, but then I drank my life away in 2008 and had to move to Delaware. So when I started, I lived in a halfway house in Delaware, driving to Philly with a breathalyzer on my car to make it work, picking up my buddies. And then I moved from that halfway house to New York. So like those guys were great for including me in the Philly crew, but I, you know, I'm a Delaware guy. And then once we got up in New York, that's when Shane started coming up. I think like maybe like 2015, 2016 or something, 17. I don't know, but we became fast friends once he started coming up to New York. Cause we used to just rip cigs outside of shows. Cause, I would only hang out with people I knew from Philly, because a lot of these New Yorkers were crazy, you know? So it was very like an us against them thing, which, you know, I don't know. I guess it's like another Philly thing, but it's, I don't know. It's neat. Not a lot of places have that.
You know? Okay, dude, you just made me so happy because I've never met somebody else who had to deal with the breathalyzer on the car, but I also had to deal with that around the same time. It is truly one of the most humbling things you can possibly go through on a date or otherwise, that you're going 65 miles per hour on a highway, and all of a sudden you have to pull this beeping contraption up from your seat and blow into it to prove to the state that you haven't had any alcoholic beverages or mouthwash for that matter.
Oh, yeah. And not only that, Trey, but this is how they f*** you. They charge you to put it on the car.
Yep.
They charge you to calibrate it, and they charge you to take it off.
Yep.
And it's, I mean, talk about a first impression, you know, picking up someone you barely know on a date. You're like, hey, honey, something's got to get in this car. One drives it and the other starts it. So what's it going to be, you know?
Oh, God, that was great. Oh, man. All right, Ian, just a couple more questions here, and I do appreciate the time today. Smart people tend to ask themselves a lot of questions, and typically there's one overriding question at a given point in time. For you, as somebody who strikes me as really smart, sharp, you're quick, is there that one overriding question for you right now? And if so, what is it?
I guess, thank you for that compliment. I appreciate that, Trey. I guess it could be, what can I do better? I'm always trying to improve myself, and my biggest goal is the only thing I want to do is be a great stand-up and a great person, you know, and I think those go hand in hand, because I think for me, finding truth in your own life and living a certain truthful, honest way is the only way to be better off stage. But also for me, that's where I want my comedy to be, absolute truth, whether it's truth in the moment or truth in how I see things. And one feeds the other, you know. So I'm constantly asking myself, like, trying to distill down, like, what separates the real from the unreal? What's the truth, and how can I be better? I just want to make today better than yesterday and tomorrow better than today. And I think constantly seeking and questioning is the way to go.
Beautiful answer there. And that dovetails nicely into my last question. What do you love about stand-up?
Oh, man. I mean, okay, you want to talk about truth? The attention, the immediate gratification, the love, an audible hug that I didn't get when I was a kid. That's what I love, you know? No, but in to be serious about it, I think I do love the seeking, you know, like always trying to seek and be better and always trying to go, okay, like, when I go on stage, I try to, I'll tell myself, go as long as you can without telling a joke. And so, because I have jokes, obviously I have an act, but I get such an exhilarating feel out of not knowing where I'm going to go or what I'm going to say, and training myself to speak in jokes and find the funny wherever it goes. And that's my favorite thing right now is finding the funny in no matter what I do or what I say. And that's been really, really fun for me. And I feel like I'm like an ornery kid again when I'm on stage making people laugh by just being silly and figuring it out right before your eyes, you know?
Especially if you're featuring for Dave Attell. At that point, you have no choice but to find new things to talk about. And yeah. Look, he is not featuring for Dave Attell this weekend at Creek in the Cave. He is headlining. I am bummed not to get to be a part of this, but I'm going to be at a bachelor party in West Texas. You should check it out, though. There's two shows Friday, two shows Saturday. CreekintheCave.com is where you should go to grab tickets for Ian Fidance. You can also check out his website, IanFidance.com. That last name is spelled FIDANCE.com. Ian, a real pleasure, man. Thank you so much for the time today.
Thank you, Trey. I really appreciate you reaching out and making time for me as well. So thank you so much, man.
Coming up in Where Are We At in Society, Adidas is 2024-ing the number 44 because it looks a little bit too much like a Nazi symbol.
It's Sports Day Plus with Trey Elling. It's Sports Day Plus with Trey Elling.
All right, final segment of the show means it's time for...
Where are we at in society today?
That's right, it is your look at stories that show we as a people are headed in the wrong direction. Very occasionally, I will bring you a story that provides a sense of optimism, that has us all saying to ourselves, hey, maybe we as a people are starting to figure something out, but sadly, today is not that day. And we start in the world of soccer today, where Adidas, which is a very popular apparel maker, I feel like they make soccer balls too, has banned a number on German soccer jerseys over concerns that it resembles the Nazi SS symbol. The number is 44. And yeah, the font that Adidas for some reason decided to use does in fact look a little bit like the SS symbol that the Nazis popularized in the late 30s and 1940s. Adidas has barred German fans from customizing soccer jerseys with the number 44 after concerns that the figures do represent this World War II era Nazi symbol. The German Football Association's font used on the custom jerseys on Adidas' website makes the digit 44 look like two lightning bolt designs that were commonly associated with the SS, the major paramilitary organization under Hitler. Attention was drawn to the sign over the weekend, and Adidas acted very quickly from there. Boy, how much is a jersey with a 44 on it for the German national team? Not that you should be wearing that, but I'm guessing that is now worth something a little bit more than it might have this weekend. Again, you shouldn't be wearing that jersey unless you're going to try and pull it off ironically. It's not going to come across as ironic. It's just going to look stupid, and you may get beaten to a pulp as a result, too. That's not right either, necessarily. I'm just saying, that's the risk that you take wearing the 44 that looks like an SS symbol. An Adidas spokesperson did confirm that they are blocking the personalization of the jerseys with the number 44. The company rep also said that, quote, divisive or exclusionary views are not a part of the values of the brand, but Adidas stands for the promotion of diversity and inclusion, yada, yada. I don't mean to be flippant there, but we know corporate jargon when we hear it. That is virtue signaling at its finest. We actively oppose xenophobia, anti-Semitism, violence, and hatred in any form. Thanks, Adidas. Thank you for making that clear. I think at this point, we should only point out when companies suggest otherwise, because you would assume that everybody is operating on that level. Perhaps an ignorant assumption by me, but especially in corporate America, where quite often, this sort of rhetoric is just that. It is rhetoric. It's the same phrase said over and over again until it's cliche, where oftentimes the actions don't back up those sentiments. Adidas is actually behind the scenes. This is hilarious, and this speaks to the reality of things here, even amidst the words of diversity and inclusion. Adidas blamed the German Football Association for the controversy, adding in a statement to a local newspaper, this would be the New York Post, that the governing body of soccer in Germany and its partner 11 Team Sports are responsible for the digit's design. Reps for 11 Team Sports didn't respond to a request for comment. The association, also known as the DFB, took to Twitter, where it insisted that they check the numbers 0 through 9 and then submits those numbers to the UEFA, that's the Union of European Football Associations, for review. None of the parties involved saw any proximity to Nazi symbolism in the development process of the jersey design. It does look a little bit like an SS, but how stupid would somebody have to be to actually want to wear Nazi symbolism on their soccer jersey? Is it an overreaction? I don't know. It looks like the symbol, but it is also 2-4, so you decide for yourself. Unfortunately, this is probably going to be the last story for this evening and where are we at, and it is a gruesome one. Just be glad that you can't see the X-ray photographs that I'm looking at right now as I read you this story. A Vietnamese man had a live eel surgically removed from his abdomen. And doctors believe it got there by slithering up his cornhole. The stomach turning discovery was made when the unidentified man, who is a 34-year-old Vietnamese man, went to a Vietnamese medical center with severe abdominal pain last week. Doctors believe the creature entered the man's body somehow through his rusty bullet hole and slid into his colon. The eel was found after doctors performed an ultrasound and x-ray, which showed a foreign object was inside the man's digestive tract. From the head of surgery at this medical outlet, this is a rare case. The rectal area has a lot of stuff going on that is easily infected with bacteria, but it was performed safely, so the surgery did not have any additional problems. The eel caused intestinal perforation, as well as a condition that causes inflammation in the stomach or abdomen. The man was kept in the hospital after the surgery and reported having mild abdominal pain after waking up. I will ask the question that you're all wondering right now. First of all, why am I reading this story? I don't know. It's vile. It's gross, but maybe it's a word of warning. But how did a 12-inch eel somehow make it into somebody's stomach through their leather Cheerio? How? Is it a simple toilet bit? Are Vietnamese toilets that riddled with 12-inch eels? And if you sit down to do your business, you have to double-check things down there because that could happen? And if it starts to happen, don't you recognize and take action? What I'm wondering is if there's maybe, how do I put this? Remember the urban legend from the 1990s? I have no idea how we all know about this, by the way. This was pre-internet being what it is today, where it's information overload. Maybe it was the National Geographic and we all read that headline as we were waiting to check out at the grocery store in the 1990s. But remember the Richard Gere gerbil bit? Remember that one? Yeah, of course you do. You were alive and somewhat coherent in the 90s. Even if you weren't, you probably heard about it. In the years that followed, it's one of the more impressive urban legends of all time. Is it something like that? Where this is a little bit more intentional than dude is willing to let on? It's like the old Seinfeld bit or the show from Seinfeld, not a stand-up bit of his, but where Kramer accidentally received the wrong license plate as man. He wondered if it was a proctologist, and proctologists have the best stories, and the stories always end with, I swear, doc, I have no idea how it ended up there. Is that what's going on here? Where the guy really knows what's going on here? Where he's getting a little bit too experimental back there and ended up with a 12-inch eel in his stomach as a result? That's why you don't experiment too much with these things. Not even going to say not that there's anything wrong with that. There is clearly something wrong with what this guy did because he had to have emergency surgery to get a 12-inch eel out of his stomach. Oh, boy. 12-inch eel. All right, we do have time for one more quick story here. You know how Band-Aids are supposed to help to keep you healthy or healthy-ish, I guess. Band-Aids cover up scrapes, open scrapes that if they get infected can become much worse. Well, and more evidence that everything is bad for you. It looks like there are cancer-causing forever chemicals in Band-Aids where they can get directly into the blood through open wounds. This is from a report that found PFAS chemicals which are sometimes used to make adhesives and are part of the normal manufacturing process. Fluorine is one of the chemicals. It's also used to make rocket fuel, can lead to skin burns and eye damage. But it's most dangerous when inhaled, so stop huffing your Band-Aids. That's not good for you. PFAS chemicals can easily enter the bloodstream after a person drinks water or eats food laced with them. Once in the bloodstream, PFAS can lodge themselves within healthy tissue or can begin to damage the immune system, the liver, the kidneys, and other organs. So again, even the stuff that you think is healthy is somehow bad for you. That's the moral of today's story. All right, that is it for another edition of Sports Day Plus. I'll be back tomorrow at 6. It's going to include a replay of my Tony Hawk interview from earlier this week and a conversation with musician Sin Kane, who has a new album out tomorrow. In the meantime, have yourselves a great rest of the evening and hook 'em.
It's Sports Day Plus with Trey Elliott.